Although the warship was only 10 miles off, already her shape was fading into the deepening dusk, for the sea breeze had chopped the surface to a wave-flecked immensity, and the sun behind Jake was touching the watery horizon and throwing the east into mysterious blue shade. Suddenly, a bright prick of light began winking rapidly from the hazy shape of the warship, and Jake read the urgent query. "What ship?" And Jake grinned and tried to judge how conspicuous the schooner with her mass of canvas was to the destroyer, and to decide the moment when he should trade speed for invisibility. The destroyer was signalling again. "Heave to, or I will fire upon you." "Bloody pirates," Jake growled indignantly, and cupped his hand to bellow down at the bridge.
"Get the canvas off her."
On the deck far below, he saw the Greek's face, pale in the dusk, looking up at him, then heard his orders repeated, and watched the motley crew climb swiftly aloft. Jake glanced back towards the tiny dark shape of the destroyer on the limitless dark sea and saw the angry red flash of her forward gun bloom in the dark. He remembered that flash so well, and his skin crawled with the insects of fear as he waited out the long seconds while the shell climbed high in the somber sky and then fell towards the schooner. He heard it come, passing overhead in a rising shriek, before it pitched into the sea half a mile ahead of Hirondelle. A swift, blooming pillar of spray gleamed in the last rays of the sun like pink Carrara marble, and then was blown swiftly away on the wind. The crewman froze in the rigging, petrified by the howling passage of the shot, and then suddenly they were galvanized into frantic, babbling activity, and the gleaming white canvas disappeared as swiftly as wild goose furls its wings when it settles onto the lake surface. Jake looked back at the destroyer and searched for seconds before he found her. He wondered what they would make of the disappearance of the sails. They might believe the Hirondelle had obeyed the order to heave to, not guessing that she was under propeller power as well. Certainly she would have disappeared from their view. Her low, dark hull no longer beaconed by the towering white pyramid of canvas. He waited impatiently for the last few minutes, until the warship itself was no longer visible from the masthead, before bellowing down to the Greek the orders that sent Hirondelle swinging away into the wind and pounding back into the head sea along her original track, sidestepping the headlong charge of the destroyer. Jake held that course while the tropical night fell over the gulf like a warm, thick blanket, pricked only by the cold white stars. He strained his eyes into the impenetrable darkness, chilled by the fear that the destroyer captain might have double-guessed him and anticipated his turn. At any moment he expected to see the towering steel hull emerge at close range from the night and flood the schooner with the brilliant white beams of her battle lights and hear the squawking peremptory challenge of her bullhorn. Then, suddenly, with a violent lift of relief, he saw the cold white fingers of the lights far behind, at least 6 miles away, at the spot where the destroyer had seen him taking in sail. The captain had bought the dummy, believing that Hirondelle had heaved to and waited for him to come up. Jake threw back his head and laughed with relief before he caught himself and began shouting new orders down to the deck, swinging the schooner once again across the wind onto the reciprocal of the warship's course, and beginning the long, delicate contest of skill in which the Hirondelle ducked and weaved on her old course while the warship plunged blindly back and forth across the darkened gulf, searching desperately with the mile-long beams of the battle lights for the dark and stinking hull of the slaver, or switching them off and running under full power with all her ports darkened in the hope of taking Hirondelle unawares. Once the destroyer captain almost succeeded, but Jake caught the flashing phosphorescence of her bow wave a mile off. Desperately, he yelled at the Greek to heave to, and they lay silent and unseen, while the low, greyhound-waisted warship slid swiftly across their bows, her engines beating like a gigantic pulse, and was swallowed once again by the night. The nervous sweat that bathed Jake's shirt dried icy cold in the night wind as he put Hirondelle cautiously on course again. 2 hours later, he saw the lights of the destroyer again, a glow of white light far astern that pulsed like summer sheet lightning as the arc lamps traversed back and forth. Then there was only the stars, and the many hours later, the first steely light of dawn growing steadily and expanding the circle of the dark sea around the schooner. Chilled to the bone by the night wind and the long hours of inactivity, Jake swept the horizon back and forth as the light strengthened, and only when he knew that it was empty of any trace of the warship did he close the telescope, climb stiffly from the crow's nest, and begin the long, slow journey down the rigging to the deck below. Papadopoulos greeted him like a brother, reaching up to hug him and breathe garlic in his face, and Vicky had the chop box open and the primer stove hissing. She brought him an enamel jug of steaming black coffee and looked at him with a new respect tinged with admiration. Gareth opened the hatch of the turret, from which during the whole night he'd commanded the crew with a loaded Vickers machine gun, and came to fetch the other mug of coffee from Vicky and gave Jake a cheroot as they moved to the rail together. "I keep underestimating you," he grinned, as he cupped his hands around the flaring match he offered Jake. "Just because you're big, I keep thinking you're stupid." "You'll get over it," Jake promised him. Instinctively, they both glanced across the deck at where Vicky was breaking eggs into the pan, and they understood each other very clearly. She shook them both awake a little before noon. They were sprawled on their blankets in the shade, under one of the cars, trying to catch up on the sleep they'd missed that night. However, they followed Vicky without protest to the bows, and the three of them peered ahead as the low, lion-coloured coastline, upon which the surf creamed softly, and over which the hard, aching blue shield of the sky blazed with an intensity that hurt the eyes. There was no clear dividing line between earth and sky. It was blurred by the low mist of dust and heat that wavered and rippled like the yellow mane of the lion. Vicky wondered whether she'd ever seen such an uninviting scene, and decided that she'd not. She began to compose the words with which she would describe it to her tens of thousands of readers. Gregorius came up to join the group. He discarded the Western dress and donned instead the traditional shama and tight breeches. He'd become the man of Africa once again, and the smooth chocolate-brown face with its halo of dark, thick curls was lit by the passion of the returning exile. "You cannot see the mountains. The haze is too thick," he explained. "But sometimes in the dawn, when the air is cooler..." And he stared into the west, with his longing expressed clearly in the flashing eyes and upon the full sculptured lips. The schooner crept inshore, gliding over the shallows where the water was like that of a mountain stream, so clear that they could make out every detail of the reef 30 feet down, and watch the shoals of coral fish below like bejeweled clouds through the crystal waters. Papadopoulos turned the Hirondelle to approach the shore at an oblique angle, so that the details of the coast resolved themselves gradually, and they saw the golden red beaches, broken by headlands and points of jagged rock, and beyond it the land arose gradually, barren and awful, speckled only with the low, scrubby Spina Christi and camel grass. For an hour they ran parallel with the shore, 1,000 yards off, and the group by the rail stood and stared at it with fascination. Only Jake had left the group and was making the preparations to begin unloading, but he also came back to the rail when abruptly a deep bay opened ahead of them. "The Bay of Chains," said Gregorius, and it was clear how it had got its name, for, huddled under the cliffs of one headland and protected from the prevailing winds and the run of the surf by the horn of land, were the ruins of the ancient slave city of Mondi. Gregorius pointed it out to them, for it did not look like a city. It was merely an area of broken rock and stone blocks running down to the water's edge. They were close enough now to make out the roughly geometrical layout of smothered streets and roofless buildings. Hirondelle dropped anchor and snubbed up gently. Jake finished his final preparations for unloading and crossed to where Gareth stood by the rail. "One of us will have to swim a line ashore." "Spin you for it," suggested Gareth. And before Jake could protest, he had the coin in his hand. Heads. Jake looked resigned.
Bad luck, old son. Give the sharks my love.
Gareth smiled and stroked his moustache. Jake balanced on the clumsy pontoon raft as it was lifted by the donkey engine and lowered over the side, dangling on the heavy lines. It settled onto the surface and floated alongside as ungracefully as a pregnant hippo. Jake grinned up at Vicky, who was leaning over the rail, watching with interest.
"Unless you want to be blinded with splendor, you better close your eyes."
For a moment, she didn't understand, but then, as he started to strip off his shirt and unbutton his pants, she turned modestly away. With the end of a coil of light line tied around his waist, Jake plunged naked into the sea and struck out for the shore. Vicky's curiosity got the better of her at this stage, and she glanced slyly overboard. There was something so childlike and defenseless about a man with his trousers off, she thought, as she considered Jake's bobbing white buttocks. She might develop that as a theme in one of her columns, she thought, and then realized that Gareth Swales was watching her with one mockingly raised eyebrow as he paid out the coil of line that snaked after Jake. She blushed pinkly under her tan and hurried away to make sure her typewriter and personal duffel bag were packed away into Miss Wobbly. Jake touched bottom and waded ashore to secure the line onto one of the stone blocks, and already the first car was on its wooden blocks and, with a winch clattering, was being lifted over the side. With each man performing his own task skillfully, one at a time the cars were lowered onto the bobbing raft. There its wheels were hastily lashed, and it was hauled carefully towards the beach by the landline. As soon as the raft ran aground on the sloping yellow sand, Jake started the engine, while Gregorius clamped the footboards into place. Then, with the engine revving noisily and the raft swaying dangerously, it rolled over the footboards and up the slope to park well above the high water mark. Then the raft was hauled back alongside the schooner for its next load. Although they worked as swiftly as safety would allow, the hours sped away just as swiftly, and it was late afternoon when the last load of fuel drums and wooden cases, with Vicky Camberwell sitting on top of the precarious load, made the short crossing to the beach. Almost the instant it left the ship's side, the diesel thumped into life. The anchor chain rattled in over the bows, and Papadopoulos gave the order to cast off the line of the raft. By the time Vicky jumped down on the crunchy sand, the Hirondelle was moving steadily out between the horns of the bay and spreading her wings of white canvas to the evening breeze. The four of them stood on the beach in the lowering dusk and watched her go. None of them waved, yet they all felt at loss at her going. Stinking slaver, with a crew of pirates, yet she'd been their link with the outer world. Hirondelle cleared the cliffs and caught the full drive of the wind, heeled eagerly and went away, with her wake leaving a long, oily slick across the surface long after she'd disappeared into the gulf. Jake broke the spell of silence and loneliness that held them. "All right, my children, let's make camp." They'd landed on the open beach between the ruined city and the headland, and now the evening wind was sweeping dust and grit across the exposed position. Jake selected a sheltered hollow under the lee of the ruins, and they moved the cars up and parked them in the protective hollow square of the lager. The ancient buildings were choked with piled sand and thick with the spiny camel thorn growth that blocked the narrow streets. While Jake and Gregorius checked the fueling and lubrication of the vehicles, and Gareth scraped a fireplace against a shielding stone wall, Vicky wandered off to explore the ruins in the dusk. She didn't go far. A tangible sense of menace and human suffering seemed to emanate from the rubble of buildings that had been burned over a century before. It made her skin crawl. But she picked her way cautiously along a narrow alleyway that opened at last into an open square. She knew instinctively that this had been the trading square of the slave city, and she imagined the long chained lines of human beings. The pervading aura of their misery still persisted. She wondered if she could capture it on paper,
and make her readers see that it had not changed. Once again, a consuming greed was to place a nation in chains. Once again, hundreds of thousands of human beings would be forced to learn the same misery that this city had engendered. She must write that, she decided. She must capture the sense of outrage and despair she felt now and convey it to the civilized peoples of the world. A small scuffling sound distracted her, and she looked down, then drew back with a shudder from the finger-length purple scorpion, with its lobster claws and the high curved tail, bearing a single hooked fang that scuttled towards the toe of her boot. She turned and hurried back along the alleyway. The chill of horror stayed with her, so that she crossed gratefully to the bright fire of thorn twigs that blazed under the ruined wall. Gareth looked up as she knelt beside him and held out her hands to the blaze.
"I was just coming to look for you. Better not wander off on your own."
"I can look out for myself," she told him quickly, with an edge to her voice which was becoming familiar.
"I agree,"
he smiled placatingly at her. "Bit too damned well, I sometimes think." And he dug in his pocket.
"I found something in the sand as I was digging the fireplace."
He held out a broken circle of metal which gleamed yellow in the firelight. It was fashioned as a snake bangle, with a serpent's forged head and coiled body. Vicky felt her irritation evaporate magically.
"Oh, Gary!" She lifted it in both hands. "It's beautiful. Is it gold?"
"I suspect it is." She slipped the heavy bangle over her wrist and admired it with a glowing expression, twisting it to catch the light. "Not one of them can resist a gift," Gareth thought comfortably, watching her face in the dancing firelight.
"It belonged to a princess who was famous for her beauty and her compassion to besotted suitors," said Gareth lightly. "So I thought it fitting that you should have it."
"Oh," she gasped, "for me?" And impulsively she leaned forward to kiss his cheek, and was startled when he turned his head quickly and her lips pressed full against his. For a moment she tried to pull away, and then it didn't seem worth the effort. After all, it was a truly magnificent bracelet. In the light of the single hurricane lamp, Jake and Gregorius were studying the large-scale map spread on the engine bonnet of Priscilla the pig. Gregorius was tracing the route they must take to the shed of the Awash River and lamenting the map's many inaccuracies and omissions.
"If you had tried to follow this, you'd have got into serious trouble, Jake."
Jake looked up suddenly from the map, and 30 paces away he saw the two figures in the firelight come together and stay that way. He felt his pulse begin to pound and the blood come up his neck, scalding hot.
"Let's get some coffee," he grunted.
"In a minute," Gregorius protested. "First I want to show you where we have to cross the sand desert."
He pointed at the map, tracing a route, and not realizing that he was talking to himself alone. Jake had left him to interrupt the action at the fireside. Vicky awoke in the first uncertain light of dawn to the realization that the wind had dropped. It had whistled dismally all night, so that now, when she pulled back her blanket, it was thickly powdered with golden grit, and she could feel it stiff in her hair and crunchy between her teeth. One of the men was snoring loudly, and there were three long blanket-wrapped bundles close together, so that she was not sure which of them it was. She fetched her toilet bag, towel, and a change of underwear, then slipped out of the laager, climbed the slope of the dune, and ran down to the beach. The dawn was absolutely still, the surface of the bay as smooth as a sheet of pink satin as the glow of the hidden sun touched it. The silence was the complete silence of the desert, unbroken by bird or beast, wind or surf, and the dismay she had felt the previous day evaporated. She stripped off her clothing and walked down the wet sand that the tide had smoothed during the night and waded out into the pink waters, sucking in her belly against the sudden chill of it and gasping with pleasure as she squatted suddenly, neck deep, and began to scrub her body of the night's grit and dirt. When she waded ashore, the sun was cresting the sweeping watery horizon of the gulf. The tone of light had altered drastically. Already the soft hues of dawn were giving way to the harsher brilliance of Africa, to which she'd become accustomed. She dressed quickly, bundling her used underwear in the towel and combing her wet hair as she climbed the dune. At the crest, she halted abruptly, with a comb still caught in the tangle of her hair, and she gasped again as she stared out into the west. As Gregorius had told them, the still, cool air and the peculiar light of the rising sun created a stage effect, foreshortening the 100 miles of flat, featureless desert and throwing up into the sky the sheer massif of the headlands, so that it seemed she might stretch out her hand and touch it. It was dark purplish-blue in the early light, but as Vicky watched in awe, it changed colour like some gargantuan chameleon, becoming gilded with bright sun colours and beginning at the same time to recede swiftly until it was a pale wraith that dissolved into the first dancing heat mirages of the desert day, and she felt the sultry puff of the rising wind. She roused herself and hurried down the dune into the laager. Jake looked up from the pan of beans and bacon that was spluttering over the fire and grinned at her. 5 minutes for breakfast. He spooned a mess of food into her pannikin and offered it to her. I thought about night travel to avoid the heat, but the best chances of smashing up the cars on rough road was too great. Vicky took the food and ate with high relish, pausing only to stare at Gallish Swales as he came to the fire, freshly shaven and perfectly groomed, wearing a spotless open-neck shirt and a baggy pair of plus-four trousers in an expensive thorn-proof tweed. His brogues gleamed with polish, and he smoothed his golden moustaches and raised an eyebrow when Jake exploded with delighted laughter.
"Jesus!" he laughed. "Anyone for golf?"
"I say, old son," Gareth admonished him, amiably running an eye over Jake's faded moleskins, scruffed chukka boots and plaid shirt with a tear in the sleeve. "Your breeding is showing."
Just because we're in Africa, there's no need to go native, what?"
Then he glanced at Gregorius and flashed that brilliant smile.
"No offence, of course. I must say you look jolly dashing in that get-up."
Gregorius, swathed in his chamois, looked up from his breakfast and returned the smile.
"East is east and west is west," he said.
"Old Wordsworth certainly knew his stuff," Gareth agreed, and dipped a spoon into the pan. The four vehicles, grotesquely burdened and strung out at intervals of 200 yards to avoid each other's dust, crawled out of the coastal dunes into the vast littoral, where the wind rustled endlessly but brought no relief from the steadily rising heat. Jake was pointing the column on a compass bearing slightly southerly of that which he would have chosen without Gregorius's advice. They aimed to pass below the sprawling salt pans, which Gregorius warned were treacherous going. For the first 2 hours, the fluffy yellow earth offered no serious obstacle to their passage, except that the narrow solid tyres cut in deeply and created a wearying drag that kept the speed down below 10 miles an hour, and the old engines grinding in the lower gears. Then the earth firmed, but was strewn with black stone that had been rounded and polished by the grit-laden wind, and varied in size from acorns to ostrich eggs. Their speed dropped away a little more, as the cars bounced and jolted over this murderous surface, and the black rock threw the heat back at them, so that they rode with all hatches and engine louvers wide open. Though all of them, including Vicky, had stripped to their underwear, still they ran with sweat that dried almost immediately. It oozed from their pores. The exposed metal of the cars, although it was painted white, would blister the hand that touched it, and the engine heat and the stench of hot oil and fuel in the driver's compartments were swiftly becoming unbearable as the sun climbed to its zenith. An hour before noon, Priscilla the pig blew the safety valve on her radiator and sent a shrieking plume of steam high into the air. Jake earthed the magneto and stopped her immediately. He climbed, half-naked and shiny with sweat, from the turret, and shaded his eyes to peer out across the wavering, heat-distorted plain. There was no horizon in this haze, and visibility was uncertain after a few hundred yards. Even the other vehicles lumbering far behind him seemed monstrous and unreal. He waited for the others to come up before calling.
Switch off. We can't go on like this. The engine oil will be thin as water, and we'll ruin all the bearings if we try. We'll wait for it to cool a little.
Thankfully, they climbed from the cars and crawled into the shade of the chassis, where they lay panting like dogs, while Jake went down the line with a 5-gallon tin of blood-warm water and gave them each as much as they could drink before collapsing on the blanket beside Vicky.
"It's too hot to walk back to my own car," he explained,
and she took it with good grace, merely nodding and closing one more button of her half-open blouse. Jake wet his handkerchief from the water can and offered it to her. Gratefully, she wiped her neck and face and sighed with pleasure.
"It's too hot to sleep," she murmured. "Entertain me, Jake."
"Well, now," he grinned, and she laughed.
"I said it's too hot. Let's talk."
"About?"
"About you.
Tell me about you. What part of Texas are you from?"
"All of it. Wherever my pa could find work."
"What do you do?"
"Wrangle cattle, rode rodeo."
"Sounds fun."
Jake shrugged. "I preferred machines to horses."
"Then?"
"There was this war, and they needed mechanics to drive tanks."
"Afterwards, why didn't you go home?"
"Pa was dead. A steer fell on him, and it wasn't worth the journey to go collect his old saddle and blanket."
They were silent for a while, just lying and riding the solid waves of heat that came off the earth.
"Tell me about your dream, Jake," she said at last.
"My dream?"
"Everybody has a dream."
He smiled ruefully.
"I've got a dream," he hesitated. "There is this idea of mine. It's an engine, the Barton engine. It's all there."
He tapped his forehead.
"All I need is the money to build it. For 10 years I've tried to get it together. Nearly had it a couple of times."
"After this trip, you will have it," she suggested.
"Perhaps." He shook his head. "I've been too sure too many times to make any bets, though."
"Tell me about the engine," she said, and he talked quietly but eagerly for 10 minutes.
"It was a new design, a lightweight, economical design. It would drive anything, water pump, sawmill, motorcycle, that sort of thing."
He was intent, happy, she saw.
"I'd only need a small workshop to begin with, some place back west. I've thought about Fort Worth."
He stopped himself and glanced at her.
"Sorry. I was running on a bit."
"No," she said quickly. I enjoyed listening. I hope it works out for you, Jake."
He nodded. "Thanks."
And they rode the heat for a few more minutes in companionable silence.
"What's your dream?"
he asked at last, and she laughed lightly.
"No, tell me," he insisted.
"There's this book. It's a novel. I've thought about it for years. I've written it in my head 100 times. All I have to do is find the time and place to write it on paper."
She broke off and then laughed again.
"And then, of course, it sounds corny, but I think about kids and a home. I've been traveling too long."
"I know what you mean." Jake nodded. "That's a good dream you've got," he said thoughtfully.
"Better than mine." Gareth Swales heard the murmur of their voices and raised himself on one elbow. For a while he thought seriously about crossing the dozen yards of sun-baked black stones to where they lay, but the effort required was just too much and he fell back. A fist-sized rock jarred his kidneys and he cursed quietly. It was 5 o'clock before Jake judged that they could start engines again. They refueled from the cans strapped onto the sponsons, and once more they set off in column at an agonized walking pace over the rough surface, each jolt shaking driver and vehicle cruelly. 2 hours later, The plain of black boulders ended abruptly, and beyond it stretched an area of low red sand hills. Thankfully, Jake increased speed, and the column sped towards a sunset that was inflamed by the dust-laden sky until it filled half the heavens with great swirls of purple and pink and flaming scarlets. The desert wind dropped, and the air was still and heavy with memory of the day's heat. Each vehicle drew a long, dark shadow behind it and threw up a fat, rolling sausage of red dust into the air above it. The night fell, with the tropical suddenness that is alarming to those who have known only the gentle dusks of the northern continents. Jake calculated they'd covered less than 20 miles in a day of travel, and was reluctant to call a halt. Now that they'd hit this level going and were bowling along with engine temperatures dropping in the cool of night, and the driver's tempers cooling in sympathy. Jake took a bearing off Orion's belt as the easiest consolation. Then he switched on the headlights and looked back to see the others had followed his example. The lights threw a brilliant path 100 yards ahead of Jake's car, giving him plenty of time to avoid the odd thick clump of thorn scrub and occasionally trapping a large grey desert hare, dazzling it so that its eyes blazed diamond bright before it turned and loped, long-legged, ahead of the car, seemingly unable to break out of the path of light, dodging and doubling with its long floppy ears laid back along its back until, at the last instant, it ducked out from under the wheels and dived into the darkness. He was just deciding to call a halt for food and drink, with a possible further march later that night, when the sandhills dropped away gradually, and in the headlights he saw ahead of him a glistening white expanse of perfectly level sand, as smooth and as inviting as the Brooklands motor racing circuit. Jake changed up into high gear for the first time that day, and the car plunged forward eagerly. For 100 yards, before the thick, hard crust of the salt pan collapsed, and the heavy chassis fell through, belly deep, floundering instantly, so that Jake was thrown violently forward at an abrupt halt, striking his shoulder and forehead painfully on the steel visor. The engine shrieked in the frenzy of high revolutions and lifting valves before Jake recovered himself, then slammed the throttle closed. He dragged himself from the turret to signal a halt to the following vehicles, and then mournfully clambered down to inspect the heavy, heavily bogged vehicle. Gareth walked out across the snowy surface of the pan and stood beside him, surveying the damage silently.